This week in the Dan Cave, spring has sprung in Arizona, where the Mariners have begun their workouts. New news on the pitching front as another intriguing young starter is acquired, and new evidence that the Mariners' current rebuilding process is working. The Seattle Dragons got things started last weekend. I'll wrap up my initial impressions with a look at the good, bad, and ugly of opening weekend in the new XFL. And in the NFL, we're still weeks away from any player moves, but lots of debate among fans who the Seahawks should cut and why. My thoughts on that and a quick comparison of Mike Leach and Nick Rolovich as recruiters as well. That's all up next in the Dan Cave.
Welcome to the Dan Cave. Here's your host, Dan Vies.
All right, you guys, welcome back into the Dan Cave, episode 71, the new and improved Dan Cave Studios. Got a new computer, and it should help eliminate some of those audio problems that we've had from time to time with things stalling or having dropouts, trouble syncing live interviews as well, if this all works according to plan and as well as it has in testing so far. It'll allow me to have some of those guests on that I've been teasing and promising you for some time, because I'll be able to do so with confidence that it's actually going to be captured properly on digital audio. Let's talk baseball first, because we finally got a glimpse here in the Seattle area of spring after weeks and weeks and weeks of miserable rain. This has been a very dreary winter, even as far as Northwest winters go. We got some sunshine over the last few days. Not a lot of warm temperatures, but at least we got to see the sun, and hopefully that picked up some of your spirits as much as it has mine. But it also reminded us that it is, in some other places around the country, spring. And in particular in Arizona, spring training has begun for most clubs. The Mariners pitchers and catchers reported yesterday going through their first workouts together today. Full squad joins them next week. Although a whole bunch of the young top prospects of the Mariners, position players, are already in camp. That's always a good sign. There was some big news this week on a national level. This is that time of year when all of the baseball publications, the FanGraphs of the world and Baseball America and Baseball Prospectus and MLB Pipeline, start to put out their minor league rankings. And the Seattle Mariners have been front and center in a lot of the headlines with these rankings releases, because they have been some of the fastest movers in shooting towards number one with a bullet, to use a phrase used in the Billboard charts. Baseball America was first to put out their rankings this last week, and they had the Mariners fifth. Of all the teams in Major League Baseball, Baseball America has determined that the Mariners minor league system is fifth. And each of these publications uses different criteria. It's not all about how many big time star can't miss type prospects you have in your system. It has to do with depth. It has to do with layering, how consistently your talent base is spread out throughout your system, and by position. So they take a lot of different factors into account. But for a little perspective, to see the Mariners go all the way up to number five in a national farm system ranking is remarkable. 2 years ago, 2018, before the Mariners decided to take this approach and tear down, if you will, trade off tradable assets, try to acquire young talent, take a step back, and rebuild. However, whatever words you want to use to frame that, they were consensus dead last in baseball. If they weren't ranked 30th, then they were ranked 29th. They were widely and universally considered to have the worst farm system in all of baseball. No depth, not enough high-end talent. Last year, after making all the offseason trades between 18 and 19 to acquire Jared Kelenic and Justin Dunn and Justice Sheffield and those types of players, they were typically ranked by just about everybody in the middle of the pack. Let's say from about 13 to 18. one or two of them had him pushing the top 10. But if you were to take an aggregate of those, they, let's say they were around 15, 16. This year, number 5 by Baseball America. But that's not all. MLB Pipeline, which is driven by MLB.com, MLB Network, which is owned by Major League Baseball, has him at number 2. So in 2 years, less than 2 years, from the end of 2018, universally considered dead last, beginning of 2020, the Mariners are ranked in the top 5 in 2 major farm system rankings. The skeptics are already out. You don't have to look far or wide on Twitter to find them. And they're saying things like this. Yeah, they've been ranked that high before. Didn't produce a winner. Jack Cerenchik had them up as high as number 10. Didn't produce a winner. You see a lot of that right now online. To me, you probably already know what my opinion of that point of view is, but it's unoriginal, it's uninformed, and it's simply off the mark. I get it. I understand that the cynicism comes from a place of disappointment and pain. You emotionally invested in a baseball team and they've let you down and you're embarrassed by it and disappointed by it. And so you don't want to invest any more emotionally because you don't want to be hurt again. But here are some things that I will say about that. And while they may sound critical of people who have that viewpoint, my intention is to try to change your mind. So that when this starts to turn around in a tangible way on the big league roster and starts to result in more wins, you'll understand that there was a plan to all this. While minor league rankings do not correlate with big league success, they really don't. Over the years, if you go back and look at the top-ranked minor league systems, they usually come from some of the bottom-dwelling teams because they get to draft higher. They put more into player development, trying to gain an edge that way, but then ultimately they don't have enough payroll to make it count at the big league level. So pretty consistently, just having a top-5 ranked farm system guarantees nothing. Okay, building a 26-man roster, much different than building up a minor league system. However, that's what I'll say about this. This is the only way to go about rebuilding a franchise that was stuck in the middle like the Mariners were. Good enough to offer hope every offseason. A couple of flashy player moves. Maybe this is the one that'll put us over the top. Close enough, staying in the race long enough into the season that you buy at the deadline. But not good enough to make the playoffs. Terrible place to be. Stuck in the middle. Not drafting high enough to get impact talent. But you have a high enough payroll that you're kind of stuck, limits what you can do as far as player acquisitions go. And no ammo to go out and acquire impact talent because your farm system stinks. That's where they were. So changing it from the bottom up was the only way to go about doing this, regardless of whatever argument you want to make that they should just go out and spend $250 million on payroll and buy a bunch of free agents, which is a terrible argument anyway. So you can be cynical all you want about the Mariners or Jerry DePoto's ability to build a winning 26-man roster, but you would be really hard-pressed to make an argument that there was any other way to go about setting this thing on the right path than to rebuild the farm system. And then you'd have an even harder time arguing that it could have gone any better in the last year and a half. Remember all of the criticism from fans who think they know it all. Of each of the individual trades the Mariners made, when they traded Edwin Diaz and Robinson Cano to the Mets for Kelenic, Dunn, Gerson Batista, didn't get enough. Oh, they didn't get enough. They could have got more for Diaz on their own. Never mind the value of shedding Cano's contract, and the Mets were the only team willing to do that. That's another argument for another day, and it's one we've had many times on this podcast. J.P. Crawford, the Gene Segura trade to the Phillies for J.P. Crawford didn't get enough. There were even people that thought we didn't get enough for Mike Leake. But all that matters, and the way baseball works, first of all, is general managers make the best deal, or what they feel is the best deal. And you as a casual fan at home, with your very, very limited knowledge of other teams' minor league systems and player development programs, to assume that Jerry DePoto was taking the lesser deal in each of these deals, the Edwin Encarnacion to the Yankees deal for Juan Ten. People hated that. Juan Ten looked really, really good last year. The point I'm trying to make is this. The people who know what they're doing believe wholeheartedly that the Mariners are doing the right thing in building up their system and setting a foundation for future success. The people who know what they're doing. I'll use an analogy that relates to my own job. I'm a bartender. I'm a damn good one. I've been doing it for a long time, and I've been a manager for a long time as well. And so I have a deep knowledge of the hospitality industry, over 25 years. I make my old fashioned with brown sugar simple syrup and blood orange bitters. I've talked to people that up front don't like that idea. They think I've broken the rules. They would try to convince me the only way to make an old fashioned is with a sugar cube or white sugar. And you can believe that all you want. You can sit across from me and be convinced of that, and I'm not going to change your mind at all. But there's a mountain of evidence that my way is successful. There's the major competition I won in Seattle up against other Seattle mixologists. And there are the hundreds and hundreds of customers, experienced, sophisticated bourbon drinkers who have had many, many different versions of old fashions tell me that mine is the best they've ever had. So the point I'm trying to make is you can hate the idea of how I make my drink all you want. You can refuse to like it. You can even refuse to try it because you think your way is better. But what I have on my side is evidence from people that really know and that have tried many different bourbons over the years, many different bourbon drinks, many different old fashions. They're enthusiastic and effusive about their praise for my drink. So a year and a half into this process now for the Mariners, there's still a lot of people out there who proclaim they don't like how it's going. They don't like the process. They don't like the approach. And you can stand on that hill if you feel that way. But there's now a mountain of evidence that people who are much more invested in studying and evaluating baseball and player development and thus know a lot more about it than you disagree with you. So the Mariners open training camp, first full workout for pitchers and catchers was today. And we got some news yesterday. Taiwan Walker finally made a decision and signed a one-year deal with the Mariners for $2 million. There's $1 million in incentives as well. He gets thrown into the mix for that starting rotation. You should remember Taiwan Walker. He was a draft pick of the Mariners. He was not a first-round pick, but he was their first pick one year when they didn't have a first-round pick. Out of high school in Southern California, a very tall, athletic pitcher who, when Jerry DePoto took the Mariners job 5 years ago, said, "We feel like we have a young pitcher who can shoot the moon." And then he turned around and traded him a couple of months later for Mitch Haniger and Gene Segura, along with Ketel Marte. Walker had a really good first year in Arizona, looked like every bit the young pitching prospect they'd hoped he would be. And then he hurt his elbow and had to undergo Tommy John surgery. That was in 2018. Spent all last year coming back from it. Pitched one inning at the end of the year, and then he had some shoulder issues. Nothing serious enough to need surgery or anything else. Scott Servais today said that they are going to take it slow with Walker. There's no need to take it any other way. That he is 100% healthy, but that they're really going to take their time and build up his strength. He was throwing 93-94 in that one inning stint at the end of last season for Arizona. He's had a couple workouts for scouts the last couple of weeks. He's been clocked in the upper 80s. The assumption is that with not only continued strengthening and just kind of working back up to speed, but also with the Mariners' outstanding organizational pitching staff and how good they are at evaluating pitchers' mechanics, and their usage and how they use their stuff, that when Walker's ready, he'll be a legit candidate for the rotation. Based on what Scott Servais said today, I wouldn't expect him to be in the opening day rotation at all. I would think something more reasonable would be to take a conservative approach with him in spring training, make sure he gets up to speed, and then let him throw in Tacoma a couple of times until he really shows you that he's ready. If he is, and hopefully when he is, he represents a very interesting two-way option for the Mariners. The first of which is that if we see the Taiwan Walker of old and he's back to dealing 95 with a good breaking ball and looks like a starting pitcher that could be a number three, they could make him a part of this rebuilding process. Still only 27 years old. Now he's on a one-year deal, so he could simply enter free agency again next year and parlay that into personal gain. But what I would suspect is this. If he's in the rotation by May and pitches well, May, June, into July, throwing in the mid-90s again, looks healthy, I would expect the Mariners then to offer him an extension to try and tie him up for a couple of years. And if he refuses, then they could deal him with the deadline and get something of value long term. So it's going to be interesting to watch his development for sure. And it's going to be interesting to watch how the Mariners handle their starting pitching staff. Servais talked about that quite a bit today. Major League Baseball announced some new rules today, and the one that had been assumed all offseason and had been reported as something that was going to happen in 2020, they are instituting officially now the three batter minimum. So no more left-handed specialist situations, no more bringing a guy in to get one batter out because he dominates them traditionally. You got to face three hitters. So I think it lessens the need to have one or two left-handed specialists in the bullpen. This is going to give an edge to pitchers, regardless of handedness, who can get batters out from both sides of the plate. And in addressing that, and also in addressing kind of the candidates for the rotation that the Mariners have assembled, they all have some sort of question marks, and most of them are related to health. A group that now includes Kendall Graveman, who was the Oakland A's opening day pitcher 2 years in a row, but is coming off injury. Nestor Cortez, acquired from the Yankees. Nick Margavicius, acquired from the Padres a couple of weeks ago. These are all guys who don't project to be top of the rotation starting pitchers, the kind of guys that you can count on going 7-8 innings for you. And then you also have these young guys, Justice Sheffield, Justin Dunn. Sheffield should be a lock for the rotation. Dunn would have to prove it in spring training, might need a little more time. Tacoma. You have Marco Gonzalez, Jose Kikuchi, and then all these guys. Servais today said they'll use the bullpen differently. They have all these pitchers capable of going multiple innings, none of them looking like aces. So you may just see some extended relief outings. It kind of sounds to me like, in essence, they would keep, you can only keep 13 pitchers, but the Mariners might keep 7 or 8 of these guys. It's not like it used to be. It's not, okay, Gonzalez, Kikuchi, Sheffield, top three spots, and then let's say Graveman and Margavicius get the 4 and 5 spot. Well, the other guys have to go to Tacoma because they're starting pitchers. I don't see it that way. I could see Cortez still making this ball club. I could even see Taiwan Walker still making this ball club if he has a good spring, but they're, even if they're not ready to put him out there for 5-6 innings at a time. Whether they feel it would be more beneficial for him to start a ball game or not, we may kind of see an evolution of the opener idea where one of these guys pitches 3 innings, 4 innings. Then you bring another pitcher in that's going to pitch a couple. It's going to be fascinating to watch this. And I think it's an approach that would make the most sense for the Mariners, given who they have on hand, given some of the young guys and the innings limits they're going to want to place on these players. They're not going to want Sheffield to go out there and throw 180 innings, certainly not Justin Dunn or Logan Gilbert when he comes up. So something really to keep an eye on in spring training, and even how they use it in spring training. I would guess that they would send a lot of these guys down to B games so they can get enough starting opportunities for all of them. Let's talk some football, and not NFL to start with. I want to talk about the Seattle Dragons. We touched on it last week, but this thing is underway now. The Dragons open up their franchise history, their first game on the road in Washington, D.C. against the Defenders. They lose 31-19. Game was tied at 19 at the half, and then long trick play, flea flicker, gets the Defenders down near the goal line, leads to a touchdown. And then as the Dragons were moving the football down the field, a pick six that was costly. Austin Prohl falls down on the route. Brandon Silvers with the pick six. And that's the difference in the game. There's also a blocked punt they were a victim of that led to a touchdown. So this game was closer than it looked. And it's interesting to me, I didn't have this in my notes, but it just thought just occurred to me. It's interesting to me that universally it seems like the Dragons are picked to finish near the bottom of the XFL. And I'm not sure why. It seems like they have just as much NFL experience on their roster as other teams. It seems like they have just as much talent at the skill positions. Thought their defense looked solid. They could have won that game. A couple things go either way. Overall, a promising first weekend, not just for the Dragons, who looked competitive even though they lost by 12, but for the league as a whole. The games averaged 3.3 million views. For comparison, and really the only league we have to compare it to is the AAF. From last spring, they started, their first telecast began with 3.3 million viewers, and that was touted as a victory for the league. But viewing dropped off dramatically during that game and for every other game. And then by week two, it was a fraction of that. And so week two will really be telling for the XFL. It feels like, much different than the AAF, there's a lot of buzz. And there's some momentum coming out of week one. And a lot more people are interested in it today than they were before last weekend because they've heard some of the positive buzz. There were actually more viewers at the end of the Dragons game than there were at the beginning. That's promising. And guess which telecast was the most watched of all of them? It was the Seattle Dragons and DC Defenders had 4 million views. So a lot of eyeballs were on the league over the weekend, and I think it held up and made a positive first impression. Whereas there were some intriguing things about the AAF last year, overall the quality of play was not something to get enthusiastic about. Some other notes about the first weekend, 17,000 plus fans at every game. Darren Revelle reported that the XFL has already earned more total ticket revenue after 1 week than the AAF did all season last year. The AAF basically had to give away tickets to get some fans in seats. A lot of tickets were handed out. The Dragons, who they play in CenturyLink Field, they're only opening the lower bowl, which I believe can sit 31,000, had to open up more seating because of demand, and that extra seating sold out in minutes. As they get ready for their home opener this Saturday against the Tampa Bay Vipers. So I wanted to do kind of a quick good, bad, and ugly of opening weekend in the XFL. Start with the good. The caliber of talent, as I said, much better in the AAF. Much better. And the teams looked much more game-ready, especially the offensive lines. You could tell from the opening kickoff of the Alliance of American Football last year that the offensive lines were just not going to be conducive to any kind of sustained offensive success. And that more than anything else really kind of dragged down the level of play in that league, is the offenses just weren't very good. The quarterbacks are better in this league, and obviously that plays off of better O-line play. They were just prepared. There were less penalties. I think that speaks to a couple things. Number one, the NFL staffs. You know, just about every head coach has been in the NFL. But also the time and effort that the league took in preparing all these teams. having that joint practice session training camp down in Houston, and then having the scrimmages against each other and working through a lot of these things. They've really taken the time. The AAF was very rushed. The XFL has been working on this for a year and a half. And you can see the another thing in the good column, the TV production was excellent, as you should expect from ESPN and Fox. Production value was great. The announcing crews really lend it some immediate credibility. Steve Levy, Kurt Menefee, Joel Klatt, Brock Heward, Kevin Burkhardt. Those guys lend credibility. They took it seriously. Greg Olson sounds like a natural. He has a decision to make. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. But he sounds like a star. I love the inside looks, kind of the behind the curtain, where you get to hear the coach calling in the play. You get to hear the referees. You get to go behind the scenes and listen to the refs go over their replays on replay review plays as it's happening. Love that transparency. The merchandise has gotten better in the last couple of weeks. You can customize your jerseys now. I'll be getting my number 11 VN's jersey very soon. Under the bad column, there were some technical issues with audio, a lot of audio cutting out. Seems like they ironed it out in the second half of that Dragons game, but the first half, it was really off-putting. And I was disappointed. I mentioned last week I'd like to see some new camera angles. The AAF did that. The XFL did not. Looked pretty standard, pretty traditional. Hopefully as time goes on, they'll play around more. At least use the Skycam more creatively. And the ugly, let's talk about the sideline interviews. I love the potential of the idea. I love the idea and the effort, but the execution was really poor. Some players just suck at interviews. They need to learn who's who and who can do what. But for me also, they got to time it right. You know, we've seen some of these things over the years. Major League Baseball incorporated it finally and kind of got good at it, where they would take time to interview one of the managers or a pitching coach in the dugout during the game. But they understand when to time it and who to talk to. I love that they're willing to go beyond the fluff. When a field goal kicker, was it the Dragons kicker actually? Or was it the Defenders kicker? One of the kickers missed a field goal and they grabbed him right as he came off the field and interviewed him afterwards. And he was good. He just took accountability, said, I got to be better. It's just a timing thing. I'll work on it. I'll get it right. I like that they're willing to talk to players, not just after a touchdown. But some of these players didn't want any part of it, or some of them just didn't have anything to say. So they need to just kind of learn the personnel. Some of them worked, you know, talking to the head coaches during a down moment, that works. But those guys have done it before. So overall, some really promising things out of the first weekend of the XFL, and I can't wait to see how it grows from here. Let's talk about that other football league now, the NFL. Not going to talk a lot this week about the Seahawks. There's really nothing going on yet. We're still 2 weeks away from the scouting combine. We're over a month away from the start of free agency that opens up on March 18th. 2.5 months away from the draft. So nothing more than speculation and debate at this point. But there's a lot of debate among Seahawks fans about how to manage the salary cap, and specifically who to cut or who to release to save salary cap space or let walk in free agency. And the two biggest lightning rods so far have been Justin Britt and Jermaine Ifedi. There's a growing group of Seahawks fans now that believe that we should keep Ifedi because starting right tackles are hard to find and he's improved. And then in regards to Justin Britt, it seems like for 2 years it had been assumed that he'd be released in 2020 because it's extremely advantageous to the club to release him this year. Not a lot of dead money. They save about $8.5 million against the cap. And he was a middle-of-the-pack type center, shall we say, in the league. Now it seems like, to me, there's a growing groundswell of support for keeping him and, in fact, being critical of anyone who suggests otherwise. And this is shocking to me in particular because he's coming off ACL surgery. So you have a guy who was a good, not great center to begin with, who's making top-end money and is coming off a massive knee injury. And the idea is that we should keep him. Here's my thoughts on both those things. And typically, the cynical view of this and the point of view that's taken by the people who are in favor of keeping Ifedi and in favor of keeping Britt is they're just scared of the unknown. They don't trust the organization to sign the right free agents, and they don't believe you can get starters in the draft. Wrong. Well, on the first point, we're not sure. But on the second point, completely wrong, in my opinion. I absolutely believe that you can find a starting center who is as good, if not better, than a healthy Justin Britt and a huge upgrade over Joey Hunt in the draft. And I absolutely believe that you can get a starting right tackle as good, if not better, than Jermaine Ifedi in the draft, or he may already be on the roster. Jermaine Ifedi is going to make more than $10 million a year on the open market. If you believe Jermaine Ifedi is a $10 million right tackle, man, I got a car to sell you. I would love to show you my 2010 Ford Escape with 130,000 miles on it. I'm asking $28,000. We're going to talk a lot about offensive line options as this offseason progresses, both in free agency and the draft. But I just wanted to put that out there. I am firmly in the let Ifedi go camp and the release Britt for salary cap room camp, because I believe you can replace both. Not necessarily on the cheap. I'm not talking about relying on the draft for both of these players. There is free agency. There are options on your own roster. It's one of the biggest question marks facing the team this offseason. It'll be interesting to see how they progress, how they deal with that. I want to end on this. Didn't get a chance last week to touch on Cougar signing day, the late signing period. Nick Rolovich's first chance to add scholarship players in his first season as head coach of the Cougs. They had a big impact on late signing day. They only had about a half dozen scholarships to hand out. They were able to garner two cornerback flips. They got two highly rated cornerbacks to flip on their commitments. Chow Smith from Wyoming, a three-star, and Alphonse Oyak, the four-star corner out of Kent. And they were able to get two defensive line prospects from American Samoa to commit at the last minute, including the number one ranked prospect in the islands. And forgive me if I butcher this name, Antonio Tuiava Pule III. Number one ranked prospect in American Samoa. Also signed a couple of interesting wide receivers, but that was something Mike Leach was really good at. This is what I'll say. The Oyak signing may be an early signal as to the potential difference between Rolovich and Leach. Leach spent so little time recruiting in Western Washington. And Oyak was coached by a former Cougar. Mike Bush played basketball and football. Remember him? Rolovich was able to flip him in 2 weeks. And now Oyak wants to be a leader in helping the cause. He wants to get kids from the West Side to want to go to Pullman. He was sitting there the whole time. And Leach couldn't get him. Chow Smith and Alphonse Oyak, and I sure hope I'm pronouncing that name right. These kids have the talent, from everything I can read, to challenge for starting spots as true freshmen in an area that needs a severe upgrade in order for that WSU defense to improve. So kudos to Nick Rolovich on his first limited It's his first limited chance to sign players and add his own players. Another thing that I don't think is getting enough run, very, very few of the Mike Leach recruiting class asked to be released from their letters of intent, and very few defections from current players. Everybody seems to be on board with the hiring of Nick Rolovich from a player standpoint. And that is certainly encouraging. Next week in the Dan Cave, we're going to talk more Cougs. We're going to check in for the first time this season on the basketball program and the promising strides being made by new head coach Kyle Smith. We'll have more Mariner news as the full squad workouts begin, and I will dive into the Hawks offseason a little deeper by taking a look at some potential under-the-radar free agent signings they should consider, not the big names, kind of the middle of the pack guys that could make a big impact. Until then, follow me on Twitter at Seahawks Forever. Subscribe to the podcast if you don't already. All you have to do is hit that subscribe button. If you like the podcast, leave me a rating. That would really be helpful. I'd appreciate it. Tell your friends. I'm Dan Biens. This is the Dan Cave. Go M's, go Hawks, go Cougs, and go Dragons.